This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, December 9th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Lina Khan was a second-year student at Yale Law School when the public first started hearing about her. In an article for the Yale Law Journal called Amazon's Antitrust Paradox, she made a novel argument about the failure of regulators to curtail the monopolistic behavior of online retailers. The paper prompted a lively debate and established Khan as a central figure in a new generation of antitrust activists who charge the government with complicity in corporate consolidation and see monopolization and lack of regulation as directly contributing to income inequality. This June, Lina Khan was sworn in as the new chair of the Federal Trade Commission, the government agency responsible for enforcing federal antitrust law. Khan, who is 32 years old, has made it clear that she intends to take on the nation's biggest corporations, especially big Silicon Valley tech firms, including Facebook and Amazon. At a hearing before a House subcommittee in July, Khan discussed the regulation of big tech with Representative Jan Schakowsky.
Congressman, I think there is certainly more we could be doing under our existing authority. I do think that there are areas where the courts have scaled back our authority. There are cases where the platforms are able to claim particular privileges under the law that can create defenses that we have to then argue against. So I think there is room for more work, but there are certainly challenges as well.
Sheila Kolhatkar, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the history of monopolies in the U.S., how Lina Khan intends to radically change course, and what changes may ensue. Hi, Sheila. So good to have you back on the program.
It's great to be here, Dorothy.
Let's start by going back to the start of the 20th century, when monopolies became a major economic and political force in the U.S. Remind us what trusts were and how they operated.
The phrase a trust was developed to refer to a kind of sprawling conglomerate that had gathered up different companies across different parts of an industry and united them under one owner. And it was sort of a benign title that concealed the fact that, you know, what happened is that the owner of the trust ended up in control of every part of a particular industry. So the acquiring of the raw material, the refining of the raw material, the transportation of it, the selling of it to people, and they could completely control all of the pricing. They didn't have any competitors.
So then Louis Brandeis, as I understand it, entered the picture. Before he was appointed to the Supreme Court, he was a crusading lawyer targeting monopolies and bad labor practices. Could you tell us what he accomplished?
Well, he's really credited with pioneering the idea that too much concentrated economic power can undermine democracy. And it seems somewhat obvious, at least to some people now. But at that time, these enormous trusts had formed, and there was this line that the business moguls controlling those trusts in major parts of the U.S. economy, this line that they would use saying that competition was actually bad. It would harm American companies. They shouldn't have to end up in a price war, cutting prices because another competitor was entering their business. This was sort of a patriotic American way to do business. And Brandeis pointed out that that causes major problems, because once you have one entity in the private sector with so much power, it can begin to manipulate and pressure the political system to serve that company's interests. And this directly undermines democracy. The political system is there to serve the people. And when you have one company with so much influence, it's really harmful. And we certainly see that happening today.
And that point about undermining democracy is so crucial, you know, as we continue this conversation, because, of course, this is one of the, if not the biggest, one of the biggest concerns right now, and as our political system seems to be unraveling. So this attempt to control, you know, monopolies' power began to change, as I understand it, in the 1970s with the rise of the Chicago School of Economic and Legal Thought. What were that school's guiding principles, and how were they applied in the Reagan administration's approach to big business?
One of the most well-known, most influential figures from that, you know, that school of thinking was Milton Friedman, an economist who pushed forward this idea that companies only exist to serve their shareholders, and that a free market was superior to a market that had any kind of government intervention. So basically, companies and corporations should be left to do as they wished, and the government shouldn't meddle in their affairs. Friedman ended up being enormously influential in the Reagan administration, but part of that same school of thinking produced a legal scholar named Robert Bork, and he wrote this paper in 1978, which basically applied the Chicago School's arguments to competition policy. And he argued that antitrust law was not designed or should not be used to try and enforce fairness in the market. And the market should be left to manage itself. And the only time an antitrust regulator should get involved is when consumers were suffering because a company was raising prices. And this was a completely radical new way of looking at this issue. So it basically gave permission to companies to get bigger and bigger as long as they could make the argument that consumers were not going to pay more for their products.
And with the argument that markets could regulate themselves, and this is, you know, again, something we're now addressing directly. But I wondered, so what about the big behemoths that were, you know, exploding at the time? Walmart is one example. Are they still operating unchecked?
Well, it depends who you ask. If certainly if you ask Walmart, they would say that they are very heavily regulated. But basically, if you look at the trajectory of some of our biggest corporations from, you know, the 1970s until now, they have experienced just absolutely astronomical growth. You can never say that Walmart is a monopoly in retail now because of Amazon. For many years, it was considered to be a monopoly. And it exerted enormous political pressure on sort of policymakers. And along with that, it popularized a lot of really unsavory corporate behaviors, including really normalizing this idea that you should suppress worker wages as much as possible so you can continue delivering maximum profits to stockholders. All of the big conglomerates that we see, you know, that we have today in the economy are a direct result of this attitude. They've been allowed to buy up their competitors. This has happened in every industry in media and publishing, in the oil business, consumer products. You look at almost anything. At one point, Lena Khan told me, you know, if you go to the grocery store and you look at the detergent on the shelves and then you kind of research who produces all those detergents, while there's this vast array of different bottles with different labels and names on them, they're all produced by just two or three huge conglomerates. And the consumers would never know it. So this has all kind of quietly happened in the background, you know, as we weren't really paying attention.
And this brings us to the power of Silicon Valley today. How do the industry's biggest multinationals, Facebook, now unironically calling itself Meta, Alphabet, which is Google's parent company, and Amazon, how do they resemble the monopolies of the past? And what's different, if anything, about the relationship between monopolies and consumers in the 21st century?
Well, it's really interesting because the big tech giants have really shed light on the flaws and limitations of this consumer welfare standard that has been used in antitrust since the 70s, basically, because many of the tech monopolies, big tech platform companies, provide their core products to users seemingly for free. Facebook does not charge you to have a Facebook account. Google does not ask you to pay to have a Gmail account. You know, Amazon is thrilled if you come and buy things on their platform. You don't need to give them money for that unless you're becoming a Prime member, of course. So the thing is that they've found other ways to monetize their users without charging them money for their products. And they've been able to argue as they've gotten larger and larger that consumers are paying nothing, and therefore it's wonderful for them. So Silicon Valley has really challenged the entire way we've come to use to view this issue. And, you know, Lena Khan would argue that it's time for us to reimagine things for the modern era.
Yeah, and consumers often don't have much idea about how these companies are exploiting their privacy and other things.
consumers, for the most part, seem to be unaware of it. And sometimes they say they don't even care. But what they're not really realizing is that these behaviors, these corporate behaviors, are having far-reaching effects that may affect consumers in ways they won't even be aware of for years. One way that happens, that, you know, that Lena Khan would certainly argue, is that it, you know, it's made it a lot harder for people to start businesses in a lot of different areas. So in the end, you end up with relatively few options when you need a particular product or service. And you might not realize that's because some of these tech giants have grown so large and made it really difficult for new entrants into the market.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So it's been clear for years that more is at issue than a fair price for consumers, and that, in fact, markets don't regulate themselves for the most part. And the evidence of the malfeasance of the tech giants just seems to keep growing. So in the 2016 elections, as everyone knows, Russia used Facebook to spread disinformation about the presidential campaign and affected the results. Uber and Lyft, with their gig economy jobs, have been blamed for further weakening the middle class. Amazon has driven countless small businesses into bankruptcy. And I was struck just this weekend by a Times report on how Elon Musk contributed to deadly failures in his self-driving Teslas by refusing his own engineers' recommendations to equip the cars with really necessary safety features.
Well, so one of the hallmarks of this sort of big tech era is that there seem to be no consequences for the leaders of some of these companies you've just mentioned. And I think Facebook is a really good example of that. The FTC, the agency that Lena Khan now leads, the agency responsible for consumer protection, for bringing lawsuits against corporations that are violating antitrust and consumer welfare laws, has filed lawsuits against Facebook multiple times over the same privacy violations of its users. And Facebook says, oh, we will never do this again. We're going to change our policies. We're going to let all of our consumers know what our privacy policies are, and we'll give them an opportunity to opt in or out of having their information shared. You know, they pay a fine to the FTC, and then they go and almost immediately completely ignore it and start doing the same thing. And it's very obvious from their behavior they don't regard these regulators as serious checks. And, you know, the FTC finally sued them again and reached a settlement, and they extracted $5 billion in order to pay a fine over violations of a prior settlement over its privacy policies. So there was absolutely no consequence for Mark Zuckerberg or any of the other executives involved in those decisions. And this kind of thing has happened at all of these big tech companies.
And there's a lot of enabling going on. So one of the things you pointed out in your recent piece about Lena Khan, the Obama administration encouraged Amazon's relentless expansion and pretty much left all of Silicon Valley unchecked. Why was that?
It's one of the big disappointments of the Obama tenure, the fact that his administration overlooked these consolidating technology giants so badly. I think part of the reason is that Obama himself was somewhat enamored with technology. I think when he first came into office, there was a slightly less strong view that they were harmful. I think we were still in the era of Google being, you know, regarded as not being evil, and they represented a big shiny new area of innovation and job creation in the U.S. And after decades of deindustrialization, I think that was a really wonderful feeling for a lot of people to see this, you know, booming industry, even though many of the jobs it created were not in America, they were overseas. But the other thing is that Obama himself and many in his administration were very, very close with the founders and executives of these tech companies. In particular, Eric Schmidt, who was the head of Google Alphabet. Mr. Schmidt broke records, according to some reports, for how many personal visits he had with members at the White House. So there was a tremendous amount of influence there. And then, of course, as the Obama administration ended, many of his top advisors went to work at tech companies. This does sort of always happen, but it was really notable in this case. Dozens of people were going back and forth.
Yeah, the old revolving door.
Yeah.
And at that time, Khan was a pretty recent college graduate, at least during Obama's first term. And she was working as a researcher at something called the Open Markets Program. How did this experience shape her current approach to antitrust law?
I think she really had a strong sense of sort of right and wrong and you know, what was moral and what wasn't when she took this job. But, you know, she spent a couple of years working for the Open Markets Program. It was run by a researcher named Barry Lynn, who has been publishing research about the threat of monopoly and how it threatens democracy for many years. And he really mentored Khan in some ways and introduced her to this particular area of the law. And she was captivated by it. She did all sorts of research for that think tank on different industries, including poultry makers and the candy market and book publishing. And she told me as she got deeper into it, she started to see this issue of corporate consolidation sort of everywhere in the economy. And she could see how it was also a little bit invisible and it needed a lot more attention. And I think this was a galvanizing experience for her.
I found her revelations about the battle between Amazon and the publishing industry especially interesting. So maybe you could just go into that a little bit more.
Yeah, well, there was, this was, I would say, around the 2012 period. Amazon had really aggressively moved into the book-selling market, and publishers were fighting with the company over the pricing of ebooks, which were relatively new. And Amazon wanted the right to sell electronic books at a loss just to encourage people to buy Kindle e-readers. And this is a typical strategy Amazon has used in market after market. They sell things at a loss. They have sort of unlimited capital provided to them by their investors. And most businesses can't sell products at a loss, but Amazon is able to do this. So book publishers were saying, well, no, we need the right to set the prices of our products. And the entire publishing model was based on the idea that books would be sold at a certain price point, and publishers would use the proceeds from really big commercial books to fund the publication of smaller, more obscure, more edgy books. So suddenly, that whole model was under threat from Amazon, and publishers were kind of in a panic about it. And they were saying, well, you know, if we can't control the pricing of our products, we're going to have to stop publishing these less profitable titles, and that is harmful to the marketplace of ideas. It is harmful to democracy. And of course, ironically, during this period, the Justice Department filed a lawsuit against book publishers accusing them of price fixing. And at the time—
I know, that was the thing that really got me.
It was a little bit crazy. And of course, you know, the publishers were astonished by this and they were saying, this is nuts. Like, we're facing existential threat from this company that has no problem selling products. It was perhaps a bit of an example of how the Justice Department really didn't understand what it was dealing with. And the publishers could see where Amazon was going well before antitrust enforcers could at that moment.
So Khan quickly joined the ranks of what has been called a new Brandeis movement, and many of them are now also part of the Biden administration. Could you just quickly outline who else is part of this movement? It does seem to be perhaps the biggest policy difference between Biden and Obama.
Yeah, I've been somewhat impressed and surprised by President Biden's apparent sophisticated understanding of this issue. I don't think anyone was expecting him to be such a pro-antitrust enforcement president, but he has appointed a handful of people who are really at the forefront of this new way of thinking about antitrust. One of them is Tim Wu, a fairly well-known Columbia Law School professor who wrote a very influential book called The Curse of Bigness, which outlined some of these ideas. And he's argued very vocally that Facebook should be broken up. And then perhaps even more importantly, the president nominated Jonathan Cantor to lead the antitrust division of the Department of Justice. And that is a really important job that, he will be in charge of deciding when the Justice Department is going to go after companies for violating antitrust law, and he can bring criminal cases, which is a big deal. I mean, those are the sorts of cases that really deter bad behavior. So Cantor made his name both at Paul Weiss, the big corporate law firm, and then in private practice, working with companies that were making kind of antitrust claims against big tech firms. So he really has a lot of experience in the trenches, you know, litigating. And members of the new Brandeis movement were thrilled when he got that job.
Both parties are now increasingly concerned about the unchecked power of big tech. There was strong bipartisan support for hearings held by the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Antitrust, which began in 2019. And under Trump, the FTC filed a sweeping antitrust case against Facebook, which Khan refiled this summer. Maybe tell us about the role that Khan played in those hearings, particularly in 2020, when the biggest tech CEOs were called to testify, Bezos of Amazon, Pichai of Alphabet, Cook of Apple, and Zuckerberg of Facebook.
So the House Judiciary Committee formed a subcommittee on antitrust issues, and this was led by David Cicilline, who's a representative from Rhode Island, and he almost immediately tapped Lina Khan to come and serve as a special sort of advisor to the committee. And she and other members of this group who were investigating the tech companies for this committee spent months sending subpoenas, you know, tussling back and forth with the lawyers for these companies, reading the companies' emails after the subpoenas had been adhered to and the companies had handed over documents. And they formed this enormous body of research about the corporate behavior of, you know, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, and Google over the last 10 plus years. And they had internal emails and they had internal projections and they had documents. So it was really remarkable. Most congressional investigations now do not go into that level of detail. They don't do that kind of work. But the House members decided that this was really important. And, you know, I think that part of that is fueled by this larger concern about the state of our democracy. So then you had this remarkable hearing in July of 2020 where the CEOs of all these companies came and testified. And I love watching the video of this because Lena can be seen sitting in the background with, you know, with like a notebook and a mask on. And it was an incredibly feisty a kind of aggressive hearing with these CEOs. And we just don't see that very often in Congress anymore. But, you know, these Congress people were armed with data and documents. And anytime Mark Zuckerberg tried to distract or dissemble or mislead, they could pull out an email and say, well, didn't your COO say X on this date that contradicts what you're saying? And it was a historic moment.
And has there been any after effect?
Well, Congress, there have been many bills filed and that are at different stages in both the House and the Senate that would deal with different aspects of competition and monopolistic behavior, especially among the tech companies. And also this congressional investigation produced a giant report. It was over 400 pages long, and that is being used as an important sort of guidebook to law enforcement across the country. And you have state attorneys general, you have the FTC, you have the Justice Department all banding together to file cases against the big tech firms, and they are all at different stages. But that congressional investigation was a really important roadmap for whatever happens next.
Khan, obviously knows she won't win every case that she brings against big tech. But as you point out in your piece, she intends to change minds over time. How likely is that? This is a huge task she's taken on.
Well, if you think about how long it took for us to get to where we were before she entered the scene, it was decades of think tanks and scholars and law professors and judges just gradually chipping away at the old paradigm and reshaping this very pro-corporate view that we have now in the antitrust world. So it's reasonable to expect that it's going to take a similar sort of long period of time for us to change it again, and it will have to probably happen in really small increments, even though there is a lot of outrage right now. And that is the challenge of Lina Khan's, role now. She can really only do big things by bringing lawsuits, trying to block mergers, for example, or force companies to undo mergers that they've already closed. And in all of those situations, federal judges will be looking at the facts and deciding whether or not they agree. And I think that's going to be really challenging. Many of the people in a decision-making position in the court system now are products of the old way of thinking. And it's going to take a long time to teach them the limitations of that way of thinking and show them how they need to really expand their view to catch up with the technological age.
Thank you so much, Sheila.
Thanks for having me.
Sheila Kolhatkar is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and the Quest to Bring Down the Most Wanted Man on Wall Street. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.